Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to everybody to the Game on Sunday podcast. Can I just say first, thanks to all those people who've listened in the last couple of weeks, particularly our last podcast with Richie Holden, where we had a good number of thousand listeners, which was fantastic. I'm flying solo today. I'm on my own. Pat is away and Michael is just away as well. So speaking of Richie Holden and GA legends, I'm delighted to welcome one of the probably the true greats of football, one certainly that I have admired over the last number of years. Dublin superstar Billy McMahon. Billy, how are you?
Hey, Dwayne, thanks for having me on. Yeah, all good.
Yeah,
all good.
I believe you're kind of you've had a busy couple of days moving house. Is that correct?
Yeah. Are you good handyman?
Is it? Yeah.
No, definitely not. You can lift things. That's about it.
Yeah, so you're not putting up shelves or paying new curtains or anything like that. You're putting up lines or anything else.
No, I suppose, you know, we were on the ladder, we had a first home, and, you know, we were kind of like, you know, look, we've been through this and we'll be all right. And everybody was telling us, yeah, it's very stressful now, just keep an eye on it. God, you just don't realize how hard it is. So, yeah, look, we're there now, we're in the house now. So,
easier to run out at the Crow Park, yeah.
No, it's more stressful than any of that. I think we're going to go back playing the drums just to get away with moving the stuff in and out.
Excellent. Tell me, just before we get into the football side of things, if I could ask you, I mean, you're obviously busy very often, like since you stopped playing at this stage. I mean, I've been reading a lot about you, listening to a lot of various podcasts and shows that you've been on as well. You have some busy lifestyle at the moment.
Yeah, well, to most people it's busy. to me it's kind of, it's just who I am. I'm that type of person. I probably got those values from my parents. They were very hard working people, you know, working class people. So my mom used to have two or three jobs. My dad would be working as well, you know, so that's where I get it from. And I have a couple of businesses at the minute, and I'm doing some social work around the purpose I developed in life and stuff like that. So, yeah, like to most people, it'd be very busy, but to me, it's normal now, you know?
Yeah, and is life just good for you these days? Yeah, since you miss football? You miss it?
Oh, yeah, you do, yeah. At stages, you miss it more, and some stages, you don't miss it at all. Like, you know, the next couple of months in the winter, you wouldn't miss football at all, you know, with the slog and the weather change. But when the ball bounces on the ground and the hard ground in the summer, and you know, you go into Crow Park and you go to the big games and you see, you know, the joy and the energy you get from the other side of it and sitting in the stands, you get that buzz to go, geez, I'd love to be back on the pitch again. But look, as the cliche is, time waits for nobody, and I had my stint and I was very lucky to be a part of a special group, and be supported by the brilliant people of the GAA and the Dublin County Board and everybody else. And it's now time to support the lads that are there now.
Yeah, and I kind of, I listened to a lot of maybe we say the professionals in terms of the rugby or the soccer guys, and when they finish their career, you're on such a high. Is there a come down? How do you cope with that? Had you that kind of experience, or were you just happy enough? Time was up, time to go. The age factor, what you were able to cope with because you had so many other things going on in your life.
Yeah, I suppose the group that I went on a journey with, a lot of them retired. I was 19 when I got on the Dublin team in 2008, and I done like 14 years from then to when I retired. So a lot of my teammates that I went on that run with, successful run with, they had retired. So I kind of had one eye on what they were doing and what they were experiencing. And I suppose when I started to come to the end of my journey, I started to kind of think, oh, right, okay, you need to start, you know, building things in for this voyage because it's going to be important, starting off with your family. And I'm still not really, I don't think I'll ever be perfect at spending time with my loved ones and relationships and stuff like that. So
we all need a bit of space at times.
So I'm programmed the same way. We all are. But so yeah, I had one eye on retirement, and I suppose I probably was going to retire the year before I did. And then I spoke to the management team and they said, look, we'd love you to come back in for the year, and because I was still getting good game time at that stage.
Yeah.
And then last year I got a lot less time. I didn't play one minute in a championship game apart from the All-Ireland semi-final. I came on the last 3 minutes and played the whole lot of extra time, so I nearly got 30 odd minutes but I'd never touched the ball like on a championship. I never got any championship minutes bar that game, which is incredible, like, you know. So that was the ice on the cake for me to kind of go, okay, the writing's on the wall a little bit here. You're not getting much game time, so it's time to pass it on to somebody else, you know?
Yeah. Can I just take it back to the very start, right? Yeah, growing up in Dublin, and look, I've read a lot about Ballymun and your starting out career. Was it football all the time in terms of, like, I'm an Northside man here in Cork, right? I grew up in Northside. I remember my days starting out in terms of putting down the jumpers as the goalposts on either side, playing in a quarry, stones sticking out of the ground. It was a serious learning experience in terms of you get home from school the match day every night, playing the opposition, playing the guys up the street or playing the guys around the corner or down in a different location. Was that kind of start of all for you in Ballymun, or how did it start in terms of...
Yeah, Ballymun was special because we had the flats, you know, so... Actually, you know, you're talking about playing matches in a quarry. You know, we actually played matches lateral. So because the entrance to the flats, they were our goals. And so we'd play lateral, which is incredible. And we'd have to play around cars. But it was incredible because we had a big, massive green out the back. And we'd actually football pitches out the back of the flats. But we never really, for some reason, we never really played on them. It was much better to play on the... in the flats. I think it came down to, you know, when you're a kid and the ball, you don't really want to play the ball on the ground. You want the ball bouncing, you want to be volleying it, and you want to be
bodying it, exactly.
And
on the concrete,
that's what that gave us, you know. So the flats are great like that. But again, look, I didn't need any friends. I had loads of friends that I played football with, but they were from the flats with me, but I didn't have to call for them to go and practice because I just put the ball off the flats. So a lot of clubs, GAA clubs you see now, have wall balls for hurling, mogi and football. We had that abundance. We'd flats everywhere to kick the ball off. So, and we'd actually sometimes go to the tower blocks and see how people could kick the ball. That'd be kind of the key things that you took for granted back then, but realising, geez, my kick could have developed just from that, you know? So I started playing soccer at a very young age. I was like 7 or 8. I started playing soccer, and then that evolved playing, you know, mini leagues in school and the Holy Spirit in my primary school. And Paddy Christie came recruiting for players, and that's where it all began for me, you know, playing for Ballymun Kickhams from the age of 10 to 12. And Paddy managed me all the way up to under 21s.
My God, that's a phenomenal story. And you know, those times, I mean, you speak about maybe was Ballymun taken out of context in terms of the badness as against the positivity? I mean, your story is just incredible. And is it at all that people made out to be? I mean, you have massive memories of it. And you kind of, I read there recently where you were saying, geez, you'd nearly like to go back there to live even in the morning because you had such a good living there. It wasn't obviously perfect at all at the times, but was it taken out of context a little bit by people outside that didn't know really what was happening inside?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Well, like to be honest, there was kind of merit to the negativity of the area. You know, a lot of the stuff that was happening wasn't made up. It was with drugs and crime. The biggest thing to us is that, you know, when Ballymun was developed, it was a beautiful complex. It was developed because of the overcrowded tenements in the inner city. Very similar to the issue that we have today with the homelessness and the housing crisis that we have. That was happening back then, and they developed Ballymun, this big massive complex that was kind of, it was replicated off a complex in Germany. They brought it here, it was beautiful. Your family had to meet a certain criteria. For example, they'd have to have one person employed to be able to live in Ballymun, and they had other things as well. But in 1985, there was a big change in Ballymun. One of the biggest changes that ghettoized the community was the surrender grant. And in 1985, basically, they developed a surrender grant, which gave you £5,000 to buy a home outside of Ballymun. So what happened then was people that were working, their families could afford to buy their own homes, took that opportunity, and they bought their homes in local communities like, let's say, Kilbrook, Finglas, Kilbarrick, Talla, you know, Darndale, all around, the areas all around Ballymun. And essentially then what was left in Ballymun was people that were probably couldn't afford to do that. So people that were, you know, single parents, people that were struggling in poverty. And at that time, there was mental health issues shutting down, and that was one of the reasons why they created this. So a lot of people that were struggling with their mental health that were in institutes were actually accommodating in Ballymun. So essentially what happened then was that it became a very lucrative area because you'd got a lot of people that were struggling with poverty, struggling with trauma, struggling with their mental health. And you could say a huge percentage of those people started to self-medicate in many ways. People obviously experimented with drugs at that time. It was the rave scene. But you know, a lot of the crimes and a lot of the negativity and perception that the outside world of Ballymun would have developed came from that, but wouldn't really understand why it was ghettoized so badly.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it's amazing, an amazing story. And like out of all of this, your Paddy Christie and he picking you up and kind of tutoring you and taking you to training. And what was your first call for Dublin? You recall that?
At senior or?
At senior level, yeah. Just say senior level, yeah?
Yeah, so 2008 was my first year. So I'd been playing Dublin under 21s. The first year I played under 21s, I played every challenge game up to the championship game, and the manager then we were playing Meath in the first round under 21s, and the manager came over to me the training session before and said to me, you know, I thought he was coming over to say to me, look, you're going to be playing this way, or you're going to be, you know, I want you to do this, or worst case scenario, you're probably going to be on the bench. And he came over to me and said, look, you're not in the squad. and I was devastated. I was like, you played me every minute up to this game. Like, I was playing wing four for my first year on my 21s. And I'll never forget it. And I the one regret I had was I didn't really challenge him enough. And I just went on with it. Now, we got beaten. The following year, you know, it had a huge impact in my development, because the following year was 2008 when I got me first. I was the captain, Jim Gavin's first year as the manager of Dublin under 21s. So he made me his captain. And then I got play. Then I obviously, it was only myself and David Connolly that were actually playing for both the Dublin senior team and the 21s. So that was the first year. So Pillar Caffrey was the manager at the time.
Yeah, Pillar.
Yeah, completely different level of standards I had, you know, from being a 19-year-old going in and just, like, I mean, for example, I would have went in with me Ballymun Kickham's gear in my fourth session. And the defensive coach, who I'm very fond of, who made a massive difference in my development at the start of my career, a fellow called Ski Wade, he came over to me and he said to me, "Don't ever wear that gear up here again."
What'd you say to him? Yeah.
"No problems, Key. Give me Dublin gear and I'll wear it."
Yeah.
And he kind of smirked at me a little bit. But I really liked what he was about. I liked what kind of he wanted in his defenders, you know. But even like, they were asking me, even though I wasn't playing in a particular game, they were like, "Right, okay, after each game, everybody has to study the video. I want you to write a report and send it in to us, and we'll have a look at it." And I remember just jotting it down on a one page, writing by hand. And I think I was sitting beside Paul Casey, who was a guy that would be, you know, well respected in terms of the attention to detail he went.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. He get to the levels I did, and he was just an incredible leader. And I remember sitting beside Paul, and I remember looking at his page all typed out. I think he was studying in DCU at the. It was like an thesis he'd done. I'm looking at
a bit like Pat Spillane on the Sunday game. I can tell you that for the
Like, wouldn't believe. I was just like, "Oh my god!" So I handed it to Ski, and he says, "You need to do that again." I was like, "Okay." So yeah, the levels were unbelievable. There was such a high standard, and you know, some of the stuff that we done back then. Culturally, people were kind of like, "Do we need to be doing this?" And now it's a norm for every county to do it. Like,
yeah, that was back in 2008, Philly. Yeah,
2008. So I don't know if other counties are doing that at that time.
I couldn't see it. No, I couldn't see it. I must say. And do you think you were ahead of the posse at that stage in terms of where your background size and your this kind of detailed analysis, and you know, as well as obviously performing on the field to play, was that one of the strengths of Dublin?
Well, it definitely advanced. I can only say that group that I played originally in 2008, they'd been on the road a long time, and they'd had a lot of psychological scarring from Kerry and Tyrone and other teams, those two in particular. And I suppose there was a lot of talk around the ego possibly of what we were doing in terms of, you know, those kind of certain rituals that other teams got energy from. For example, walking to the hill, pulling each other's jerseys. That was, you know, remember, I think it was Conor Gormley, he spoke about how much energy they got from that. And I think after that, we stopped doing that a little bit. A lot of the ritual stuff we had were probably more in-house. We contained their energy in-house rather than letting them go out. You know, but a lot of the pain and suffering they went through made a massive difference to the people of Dublin GAA, because that ultimately made people dig a little bit deeper, get really stuck into the grassroots from the county board point of view and the clubs, and what came from that was incredible, you know.
Yeah, and if I asked you to describe what it was like winning your first All Ireland, I know you've won a good lot of them, but tell me about your first one. What was it like for you and your family? All those people back in Ballymun.
Well, like, it's the best way of explaining it is the way Mick McCauley explained that after getting an interview, after the match, getting an interview, he said he just couldn't stop saying it's unbelievable. It's unbelievably unbelievable, he kept saying.
Yeah.
Now, it's hard to put into words, but straight after, but in time, you start to understand the effect it had, because first of all, it opened the door. again, belief to the group that were there that he could win more than one. Had a huge impact, definitely had a huge impact of the people in Ballymun, because Ballymun never had an All-Ireland.
Incredible.
Because Ballymun, Kickhams is two parishes together. It's Ballymun and it's Glasnevin.
Yeah.
And we'd had people playing for Dublin from Ballymun, like Ian Robertson, Davey Bourne, who played in goal. But a lot of them were from Glasnevin, which is like Paddy De Christie, Dermot Deasy, Jerry Hard, and there was loads to name, you know, Barry Rock, there's John McCarthy, there was loads. But from Ballymun, I was the first one to win an All-Ireland, which was a great privilege for me, you know, to say, you know, from Ballymun now. I suppose your family are so proud of you, and, you know, it's great to go and see the coaches you've had from an underage and say, look, thanks very much for all you've done, and, you know, you have a part to play in that medal, like, you know. So it is still today incredible. It's still nice to have, like, when I go around the country and I do talks and stuff like that, and we talk about what's good about Ballymun, what's probably the perception negatively about Ballymun, the good thing is that a lot of people can say, look, they've got All-Ireland winners, you know, they're probably the most represented All-Star club, I think, in the country. I think we've the most All-Stars.
That's an incredible success story. And then, you know, you mentioned Pillacaffery, Pat Gilroy there as manager, and obviously Jim Gavin coming along and stuff like that as well. Describe Pat Gilroy and, you know, what he brought to the table as well, because when I look at him and I see his involvement kind of this year and see him down the sideline, maybe down by the half forward line, obviously he had something special to bring to the table as well.
Yeah, definitely. Like, you'll hear a lot of people talking about his involvement this year and how that helped. Possibly if he wasn't there, they possibly wouldn't have won an All-Ireland this year. You know, that's how strong people speak about him. But when Pat went in, I suppose he had to look at, obviously, you know, where the vulnerability of the group was, you know, where the kind of the, as I said, the psychological scarring of the group was. And he brought a lot of lads in that didn't have any of that. And he probably had to change the culture of the group and the dynamics of the group, because there was guys there a very long time, and it would probably have been hard for younger lads to come in and be themselves or be a different part of the group if there was the same people and the same faces kind of leading the change room, you know. So that changed the dynamics culturally. Definitely he's a very successful businessman, so bringing the business culture aspect to it was a key part that I would always recognise that had a massive difference to us. He also then, you know, wanted to challenge us psychologically, like, you know, were we actually tough? Were we mentally tough? Or did we have a soft underbelly? And you know, from what you probably would have heard of, like, you know, doing the 6 a.m. training sessions and then training that evening.
Incredible.
You know, we used to do training camps, and, you know, training camps, everybody thinks is nice and fluffy and everything else, but for us, a training camp was train, sleep. It was incredible. Like, we'd go away, train that morning, go to bed in the afternoon, train later on that day, and then we'd, you know, that's all we'd really do is sleep and train. And that, you know, thankfully that changed a little bit as we got a bit tougher over time. We started winning things. Jim Gavin didn't have to do those type of things. But that foundation was crucial, and it was a part of Pat and his management team doing that.
Yeah, and it set the standard, basically, in terms of anybody else coming into the team or into the panel and what's expected and the level that you have to be to get in there. I always remember there was a coach of mine playing hurling, and he managed the Cork football team in 1973 with the All-Ireland, Donny O'Donovan. When the All Blacks used to come to Cork for training and stuff like that, or they'd come to town, he'd go and watch them, because they had the kind of a system that you couldn't join the All Blacks panel unless you were at a certain level of fitness, mindset and stuff like that. That kind of reminds me a bit like yourselves. You had to be at a certain standard before you got in there. So when we trained collectively, as you mentioned there, and the team training and the bonding and all that, you brought yourselves to another level above everybody else.
Yeah, well, like, I mean, so if I could break it down as simple as possible, I suppose, you know, if you just look at since we won our first dollar in 2011, you could essentially say that, like, you know, I suppose the first part of it was making sure that we could win it. The second part then was creating a separation so we could win more and continue to win more. And that's probably why people struggle to continuously or consecutively win, you know, whatever sport they're in. It's a really hard thing to retain a title or a championship or whatever it may be. And I suppose we always had the paranoia around trying to get better at every element we could. Like, for example, you spoke about, you know, looking at other sports like the All Blacks. We went out to, after 2010, after getting beaten by your crowd, Cork.
We went over, I like that, your crowd, yeah.
We went over to England and we went to McLaren and, you know, a lot of us would have went, what's going on? Like, you know, what's the kind of objective of this? Like, you know, but we got into it and it was an incredible experience. You know, we thought we were going to do like a car garage, but it was like a hotel, spotless. There was no oil on the ground. It was just, everything was like done so well. Cars being lifted up and down through these big massive lifts. The gyms, the gym programming was incredible. Like, so Lewis Hamilton was actually racing with them at the time and they were showing us like some of the machines he used, like, and they had this, some of us got in the machine to use and to show us the G-force and the neck muscles that you need to use. But what was incredible was in 2010 we were a couple of points up and we were potentially going to be in an All-Ireland final. And Cork, like, I remember, I always tell the story, I remember looking up at the screen and going, Jesus, I'm going to be an All-Ireland final. I can't believe this. And about 3 to 4 minutes later, we were knocked out.
Yeah.
And
that's what the Cork boys do to you, yeah.
So we took our eyes off the ball. We were more outcome-based instead of process-driven, like, you know. But that was the kind of the first learning of, you know, focusing on your performance elements and not focusing on the outcome. But the key thing for McLaren was we watched back that game and we realised within those few minutes we actually stopped hydrating ourselves, which is an incredible thing. These are the like mini kind of micro management type things, but make a massive difference. So the Cork boys were getting water thrown into them throughout the whole game. And in the matter of 5 or 10 minutes, we hadn't took on any hydration. Now, we're at the melting pot of this game, all in semi-final, and none of us are staying hydrated. And Lewis Hamilton had a straw. It's like a straw that drips into his mouth in his helmet, but just drips water to keep him hydrated for the whole duration of the race. So we started from that day, we started getting water, small water bottles thrown in with us every few minutes. But people think about that as a hydration thing, but that's a psychological thing, because when you get the water bottle thrown into you, if it's a trigger to go refocus. Don't think of the outcome of the game. Focus on what your next job is. Focus on the next play. Focus on your next tackle, whatever it may be. So a little thing like looking outside your sport is incredible, because you can, if you really see opportunity, it'll make a huge difference for you.
Billy, my head were racing now after that McLaren talk and Lewis Hamilton and the little holes at the side of the helmet and the water coming in. Did you ever think maybe we could put one of those into an Hurling helmet?
There you go. I remember having a chat with a particular manager. I won't say which one.
Yeah.
And we were talking about, you know, changing systems during the game. And yeah. I said, you know, what about, you know, having something on the sideline that's a certain colour? And everybody looked over, you changed the system. And I couldn't believe to see South Africa doing something similar to it. Did you see what they've been doing in the World Cup, where they look up to the box and they have a light in the box?
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Have a look at it. They have, like, if they were going to, I think it's if they were going to, like, for a conversion, or they were going to kick to the touch, that there's a light. They look up into the manager's box and they have a light, and the light will determine what option they're going to take. Like, incredible.
Whatever. I'm sure there'd be a lot of water carriers out there saying, look, you have your water inside your helmet, don't be screaming at me anymore.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. Don't burn anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, brilliant. Can I just touch on, we'd say, 5 and 6 in a row and Jim Gavin as well? I mean, yeah. What a man.
Yeah, Jim's an incredible manager. For me, you know, it's probably the manager that I had my most successful stint with.
Yes.
So Jim, again, you know, as I said, he would have been my under 21 manager, maybe captain, and kind of attention to the detail is incredible. His consistency, how he done things. It's very hard to explain. It really is. And also his management team, I have to always give them recognition. Yeah. They do. Declan Darcy, Jason Sherlock. There was a couple of others there along the way as well. McDeegan and stuff. So, you know, Jim, that starts with there, having trustworthy people around them that, you know, will be, you know, have blue blood running through them. Let's say Paul Clark, another one, there's a good few there, like, you know. So,
yeah. But if I ask you, Philly, like, just to kind of look for me, looking in from the outside, and everybody looking in, like, you look at Jim Gavin, you'd say maybe like John Wayne, the quiet man.
Yeah.
Can you describe him to me? I mean, you were the guy in the dressing room. You know him so well. He had so much success together. There was a bond there. Describe Jim Gavin to you.
Well, the Jim Gavin that you see, you know, in interviews and in the media, is the Jim Gavin you see in the change room, like, you know. And the Jim Gavin that, you know, I was very lucky in that Jim Gavin stepped down 5 days away. It's 5 days before my wedding. And I tell you why I was lucky. Jim Gavin, I remember at probably 1 o'clock in the morning, looking across. I was sitting down having a bacon sandwich with everybody at the end of the night. And I'm looking across and I see Jim Gavin chatting to two lads, two club players, two mates of mine. And he's having the crack and he's up dancing. And I'm just like, this is incredible. Like this, if Jim Gavin was the Dublin manager now, he wouldn't be doing any of this. Jim Gavin sacrificed himself. That's the best thing I can say about Jim Gavin. He sacrificed, not that he wasn't himself, that's probably the wrong thing to say. He was different when he became the Dublin manager. He had to be different. He had to play a certain role where he was this person. And that person protected the whole collective and what he was trying to do in terms of a purpose with the group, you know? So the Jim Gavin you see nowadays is a lot more, you know, you can see he's a little bit more kind of a different energy about him, if the right word is I'm using, like, you know. So I think when you have to go into a job and be something different to get the best possible outcome towards a purpose, I mean, it's an ultimate sacrifice, you know. And you know, I don't mean like he's totally different person to what he was. I don't mean that, but there is a difference, definitely. You know, but he was an incredible person. Looked at a lot of things outside of the sport. You know, for players, always kind of be innovative. Always looked to bring something new every year. But you knew who was the boss, and he didn't have to scream. He just looked at you, and you know, you'd let him down, you know, because you'd went on this brilliant journey with him.
Obviously, a massive, massive element in trust. Can I just move in on this marble and sit and ask you, maybe your toughest opponent? I know you mentioned that you played Saxon out of wing forward, and
yeah,
I remember you as your corner back. Your corner forward, right?
And corner minder. I was a shit forward, so they pushed me back.
Is that right? Yeah. You weren't scoring enough as a corner forward and said, no, go back. Yeah.
And then when I went back there, I still thought I was a corner forward attacking up the pitch.
Yeah.
But toughest opponent, like, it's a very hard question to answer all the time, because I give it a very...
Yeah.
An answer that people don't like. I don't really... There's games over that period of time where like everybody got skinned or someone's done well on me. But the Dublin lads for me were always the hardest opponents to mark, because I could mark Bernard Brogan, who, like, him, Paddy Andrews, Cormac Costello, whoever it may be, they give them three steps away from you, and they're just going to kick the ball over the bar from any angle. And then you'd have Owen O'Gara, who, like, once he gets that ball, he's going to ram by you. Like, you've got...
Yes, yeah.
You know, there's loads of different styles. You've got powerhouses like Conall Callan, Paddy Small. There's just so many, you know.
Yeah, like, but you must have, you must have come up against a Garryman or a Mead or a Kildare guy or a Parkman. Yeah. So many of them you did.
Yeah, but this is the thing. Like, if I didn't do my homework on the opposition players, and they like, if a player from wherever, Meath or Kerry or Tyrone, done really well on me, it would be down to my preparation.
Yes.
And that's how good our management team was, that, you know, if I was marking Colm Cooper and he kicked off his left side coming in from the right hand side, and, you know, right in front of the D, he received the ball, all those things, that would be me not doing the right preparation. So the defensive coach, like Declan Darcy, would come to me and say, "You knew he was kicking off the left. Why did that not happen? Why did you not block that down? Why did you let him inside it?" So the players we marked, if we'd done our homework practically and theoretically right, they wouldn't be too hard to mark. Because the Dublin lads couldn't do that much time at home were gone.
Brilliant answer. You're giving me my answer. Yeah, and if I just said to you, your best performance that you feel I gave the best 17 minutes or 76 minutes of my life here in this game.
Yeah. A lot of people kind of reference the Kerry game in 2015 when I marked Cooper, but in respect to him being one of the greats of the game, and I scored him, I keep him scoreless in an All Ireland final. That was an incredible game. But the best one for me was 2016, I think it might have been 2016 All Ireland semi final, I think it was, or the final. That's how bad it is. It must be that good if I can't remember it. But I marked, I was against Mayo, I marked Aidan O'Shea, I scored 1-2. And it was the day of my birthday. I think it was the replay as well.
Yeah.
The day of my birthday. I think for me, what happened was I was marking Aidan O'Shea. He was tipped to be player of the year. He'd ran him up in Connacht. And I was just rubbing my hands. I was like, lovely. All of this is perfect for me. I was nearly going to Jim Gavin saying, "Will you please put me on this fella?" And I'd marked him inside. We'd had a tough battle. And in the first game, marked him in the second game. And I suppose they made a mistake and they said, "Right, Aidan, go out of the pitch." And I was like, "Lovely, I'm going out with you here and I'm going to hack every chance I got." And I got 1-2. So I've never scored from cornerback. I've never scored 1-2 in my life. So that would be, and I kept him scoreless that day as well. So not just because of my offensive display, it was my defensive display was good as well. So that was me. That was the best game I think I had, anyway, for me.
Brilliant, Philly. Look, you've had so many highlights. Look, we've about 7 or 8 minutes left here, and you're fantastic. You're a joy to listen to. Could I just move on? Maybe a small bit about life off the pitch. What do you work at now? You mentioned at the start, you've a couple of businesses. I know. I read up that you've done a bit of strength and conditioning for Shamrock Rovers, Bohemians. I'm seeing we love a soccer. You have a couple of gyms going. You have other businesses going.
Yeah,
life must be good for you.
Life's great. When you look at what's going on around the world today, how could you not be happy with and grateful for what you have, So for me, daily I'm working, I have my gym here, my offices are in the gym, and I have a new cafe called Wobble Cafe that I recently opened with Adrian Martin, who's my partner, this year. So that's going really well. He's a Cavan man, by the way, so we're sorry from him. I have another business called NutriQuick. I'm a co-owner of that. There's four of us on that. That's a ready-made meal company. It's in Aldi's and Dunnes and Tesco's and Spar's everywhere. So that's going really well. To be honest, I'm just very fortunate to be able to do what I can. I have brilliant staff around me, brilliant family around me. I work in Mount Joy as well. I have a program that I run in there for prisoners. And I'm looking to do a research project soon about it's more of an intervention type research project for kids that are are going through a criminal drift, that are struggling, going down a bad pathway. So I'm doing that as well. So yeah, look, I'm just really happy to be able to get the opportunity to have people around me to do all of these things. I'm really passionate about business, passionate about social inequalities in this country. Because of my background, because of my brother, because of my family, and because of Bagman, so.
Yeah, I was just going to briefly mention about that. I mean, I read about you losing your dad, the history, and, I think you'd have talked with Joe Bolly and coach. You mentioned about your dad's being interned. Your dad was shot at 16. He was interned by 19. Then you had your brother dying. And how did you cope with all that? You obviously had some inner massive inner strength. Did it make you kind of give you some different outlook in life in terms of like great relationship with your dad and your mother? Your brother obviously had a big effect on
you. Yeah, my brother had a massive effect on me because I had three sisters and a brother, and he was 7 years older than me, and he was the guy that if I got into a row with anybody, he's the guy I threatened everybody with, he was a loving brother, kind hearted brother, even in his depths of his addiction.
Yeah.
Really supports my sporting journey, pushed me further and further into sport, So I was very lucky to have a brother like John. And, when John passed, he kept supporting me in spiritually, in terms of the work I do as a purpose and trying to help people that went the same pathway he did. That was the special gift he gave me, And he's spoken about more than probably he was when he was alive, He's on the telly, he's on books, he's heard things, he's on podcasts. So he gave me that purpose to go and get after things in life. And I suppose when my dad passed away, I suppose I had two different aspects. John died very suddenly and my dad passed away after a year of terminal cancer,
Yeah. He was only 64, I think. Was he only 64, was he? Yeah.
Yeah. He was only 64.
Young man.
He was young man and probably younger than his age in terms of his, physically he was, very, very active and incredible person, very kind, humorous type of individual, but also a staying hard man, from West Belfast. And lessons he gave me was, John gave me a purpose, probably ignited the purpose, but my purpose was always there with my dad in terms of his journey, fighting in the troubles and fighting for his community and the nationalist community of Lennadoon and West Belfast. And that's very aligned to what I'm, doing with the people of Ballymun, that I'm trying to help certain elements of Ballymun that I think can be supported along with other people that are doing brilliant stuff in the area.
Yeah, I just to touch on your charity work and your help with fundraisers, and you've traveled the length of the country, but you still have a special place with Ballymun, and so you go back there on a regular basis. Is there more the government can be doing? Is there more us as a public can be doing? Do you think is it not being done to help those type of people?
Well, Ballymun is still one of the most impoverished places in the country, according to our census. And there's obviously, recently it's been regenerated. There's no flats or towers there anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
There's over €1 billion spent on the community. But culturally, it's kind of affected. It still has never changed. It's still ghettoized in many ways. It's still got certain issues in community. But nonetheless, it has brilliant people, it has brilliant activists. That's if there was a leaderboard of having potentially the best or the most community activists, Ballymun would be up there at the top. So that we can thank the people that have, being those type of people for us over the years, and that's passed down to the likes of me and others who are trying their best to do whatever they can. So Ballymun, yeah, it's a saying, we'll never forget where we come from, I suppose. Where I grew up in the flats, I only live a stone throw away from that. So I'm still near right beside the community, But if you're saying to me, how would you change Ballymun after, the community was created in probably the 50s, 60s and still got issues, what would you do? If you gave me the money now, I would, instead of where the money is potentially being spent now, I'd build a shopping centre with a GAA ground in it, and I'd create a financial incubator in the community, and I'd raise the poverty line up, and I'd make sure that everybody that would take the opportunity of working within the shopping centre and the stadium would have career paths and would basically get anybody out of the poverty trap that they're in.
Yeah, incredible, Philly. I'm just conscious of time again. I just have a final question for you.
Yeah.
And you've been brilliant. The future, coaching or managing in the future. I sense Paul Gilroy here, Pat Gilroy, sorry. I sense Jim Gavin here. Is that in the mindset with you? Because you're clearly demonstrating to me that you're one to watch out for the future in terms of coaching.
Yeah, look, I'm very privileged that I've been asked to get involved with county teams over the last 2 years. One or two of them have been very interesting for me, but the difficulty I always have it in terms of reference to whether I go into coaching or management is based on kind of two things. Will that county team, you know, will it compete with Dublin? And I just couldn't see myself being comfortable with that. There's one particular county that I was asked to get involved with this year, and I couldn't think anything worse than walking out to Crow Park and looking down the sideline and seeing the Dublin lads, and that's probably because I'm still probably really connected time-wise to the group that's there. But I suppose that's the first thing. The second thing then is I've always said the only kind of county that would really, really give me an interest would be Antrim, because my dad's from Antrim. The difficulty now is, first of all, they have a really good manager in there now, has done a great job with them, but it's not good timing for me to get involved in any county, 2-year-old son, you know. So I want to spend time with him for the first couple of years. But look, who knows? I might get a different role with the Dublin County Board and in the meantime, and that might be something that I could do that would tick the box of being passionate about getting into that world, but also being with my own county, you know.
Brilliant. Philly McMahon, can I just say to you, what an insight. What a persona, what a character. I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for giving us the opportunity to game on Sunday podcast today. It's fascinating. If you're in Cork, if you come down to the River County, give me a shout and go for the time to more.
Well,
I'll bring you around and I'll show you a few nice spots around here and maybe I might be able to go down here.
Especially on the north side.
Oh, yeah, we go around the north side. Yeah, absolutely. My private place in my heart, being on the city as well, is the north side of Cork City, similar to yourself. So, listen, it's been fantastic. Thank you very much, indeed.
Thanks, Lewis. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
Kayla Itzinas. I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.